30. A Puzzled Robot. Nerzhin almost bowled Junior Lieutenant Nadyalashin over in the dimly lit staff hallway as he rushed back to his quarters. The scrap of terry toweling was still tucked loosely around his neck and into his jacket. Just 5 minutes earlier, when he was standing in the hallway waiting to be called in, the 30 years of his life had seemed to him one long, senseless, depressing chain of misfortunes from which he lacked the strength to struggle free. And the greatest of these misfortunes had been his departure for the army so soon after his marriage, then his arrest and his long separation from his wife. Their love, he saw clearly, was doomed to be trampled in the mud. But now he had been told that he would be seeing her around noon today, and suddenly his life was like a taut bowstring, a life that made perfect sense, in the round and in detail. A life in which his war service, his arrest, and all those years apart from his wife were simply the most unlooked-for episodes in his progress toward his goal. Outwardly, he might seem unhappy, but Gleb was secretly happy in his unhappiness. He drank from it as from a fresh spring. In this place, he had gained an understanding of people and of events not to be had elsewhere, least of all in the sheltered comfort of a quiet family home. From his early years, what Gleb had most feared was getting bogged down in a life of humdrum routine. As the proverb says, it's not the sea that drowns you, it's the puddle. But he would go back to his wife. They were soulmates. The ties that bound them were unbreakable. A visit. She was coming to see him. On his birthday. And after yesterday's talk with Anton. It was the last visit he would ever be allowed in this place, but it could never have meant more to him. Thoughts flashed through his mind like fiery arrows. Don't forget to say this. Remember to say that. Oh yes, and that. He rushed into the semicircular room, where prisoners were scurrying around, making a lot of noise. Some had just come back from breakfast, others were only just on their way to wash, and Valentulia had thrown back his blanket and was sitting up in his underclothes, laughing and gesticulating as he told them about his conversation with the bossy night owl who had turned out to be the minister. Valentulia was worth listening to. But this was, for Gleb, one of those amazing moments in life when the singing inside you threatens to burst your ribcage, and a century is not long enough to do everything you want to do. Still, he couldn't miss breakfast either. Breakfast is a blessing that a prisoner is not always destined to enjoy. Anyway, Valentula's story was nearing its inglorious end. The whole room condemned him as a cheap little pipsqueak for his failure to tell Abu Kumaf about the things prisoners so desperately needed. Now he was struggling and squealing, while 5 volunteer torturers dragged his underpants off and, egged on by the whoops, howls, and guffaws of the rest, chased him round the room, warming his hide with their belts and splashing him with spoonfuls of hot tea. Along the radial passageway to the central window, Andrei Andreevich Potapov was sitting on the bunk under Nerzhin's and facing the one Valentulia had vacated, drinking his tea, watching the fun, laughing until he cried, and dabbing at the tears under his glasses. No sooner was reveille sounded than Potapov's bedding was arranged in an uncompromisingly exact, right-angled parallelepiped. The bread he was eating with his tea was very thinly buttered. He never bought extras in the prison shop, but sent all the money he earned to his old woman. He was paid a lot by the Sharashka's standards, 150 rubles a month, a third as much as a free cleaning woman, because he was an irreplaceable expert and in good standing with the bosses. Nerzhin removed his jacket as he went, tossed it onto his still unmade bed, said good morning to Potapov without waiting for his answer, and rushed off to breakfast. Potapov was that very engineer who had confessed under interrogation, attested in a signed deposition, and confirmed in court that he had sold to the Germans, and sold at a bargain price, the first-born offspring of the Stalin 5-year plans, the Dnieper hydroelectric station, though only after it had been blown up. For this unimaginable, this incomparably heinous crime, Potapov's punishment, thanks to the clemency of a humane tribunal, was a mere 10 years of imprisonment followed by deprivation of rights for 5 years. 10 and 5 on the horns, in prison slang. Nobody who knew Potapov when he was young, and certainly not he himself, could have dreamed that, nearing 40, he would be jailed for a political offence. Potapov's friends called him, with some justice, a robot. Life for Potapov meant only work. Even 3-day public holidays bored him, and he had gone on leave only once in his life, when he got married. In other years there was nobody around to stand in for him, and he had willingly given up his vacation. If there was a shortage of bread, vegetables, or sugar, he took little notice of such irrelevancies. He just tightened his belt and cheerfully continued work on the only thing that interested him, high-voltage transmission. Except when they told jokes, Potapov was only dimly aware of people who were not concerned with high-voltage transmission. Those who created nothing with their hands but merely sounded off at meetings or wrote for newspapers, he did not regard as people at all. He had been in charge of all electrometric procedures at the Dnieper hydroelectric station, and had sacrificed his wife's life as well as his own on the insatiable bonfire of the 5-year plans. By 1941 they were building another power station, and Potapov was exempt from military service. But when he heard that the Dnieper station had been blown up, he said to his wife,
"I will have to go, Katya."
And her reply was, "Yes, Andrei, you must." And off he went, wearing pebble glasses, an ill-fitting tunic, and although he had one tab on his shoulder, an empty holster. There was still a shortage of weapons for officers in the second year of the war, for which we were so well prepared. At Kastorne, in the July heat and the smoke from burning rye, he was taken prisoner. He escaped, but was recaptured before he could reach his own lines. He escaped again, but parachutists dropped around him on the open plain, and he was a prisoner for the third time. He went through the cannibal camps of Novograd-Volyn and Częstochowa, where prisoners ate bark from the trees, grass, and dead comrades. The Germans suddenly transferred him from one such camp to Berlin, where someone who spoke excellent Russian, a polite man but scum, asked whether he could possibly be Potapov, the Dnieper-Ges engineer. By way of proof, could he draw a diagram, say, of the switch mechanism for the generator? The diagram in question had already been published, and Potapov had no hesitation in drawing it. He told the story himself under interrogation, though he need not have done so. This was what was described in his case history as betraying the secret of the Dnieper hydroelectric station. What followed, however, was not included in his dossier. The unknown Russian who had thus verified Potapov's identity invited him to sign a voluntary declaration of his willingness to restore Dnieper-Ges, whereupon he would be released immediately and given ration cards, money, and any job he liked. When this tempting offer was laid before him, the painful workings of the robot's mind showed in his heavily wrinkled face. Then, without striking his chest or shouting proud words, staking no claim to the posthumous title of Hero of the Soviet Union, Potapov humbly answered in his southern brogue,
"You must know that I've signed one oath of loyalty. If I sign this other now, it'll be a bit of a contradiction, won't it?"
In this mild and untheatrical fashion did Potapov express a preference for death rather than the good life. "Well, I respect your convictions," the unknown Russian answered, and sent him back to the cannibalistic camp. The Soviet court did not include this in the charges against him, and so gave him only 10 years. Engineer Markushov, on the other hand, did sign such an undertaking and did go to work for the Germans, and the court sentenced him to 10 years also. There you see Stalin's hand, that purblind equation of friend and foe which made him unique in human history. Nor did the court try Potapov for his behavior in 1945, when, mounted on a tank, wearing the same old cracked and wired-up spectacles, machine gun in hand, he burst into Berlin with the Soviet assault force. So Potapov got off lightly, with a mere 10 and 5. Nyazhin got back from breakfast, kicked off his shoes, and climbed onto his bunk, rocking both himself and Potapov. He now had to perform his daily acrobatic exercise, make his bed, leaving not a single wrinkle, while standing on it. But as soon as he tossed his pillow aside, he discovered a cigarette case made of dark red translucent plastic that contained a dozen White Sea Canal cigarettes, tightly packed in a single layer and had a plain paper band around it, on which was written in a draftsman's neat hand, 10 years he spent thus, killing time, his life suspended in his prime. There could be no mistake about it. In the whole Sharashka, no one but Potapov was capable at once of such craftsmanship and of quoting lines from Yevgeny Onegin remembered from his school days. Gleb lowered his head over the side of his bunk and called to him. Potapov had finished his tea and unfolded his newspaper. He was reading it sitting up, so as not to make his bed untidy.
"What now?"
he muttered.
"This is your work, isn't it?"
"I couldn't say. Did you find it somewhere?"
He was trying not to smile.
"Andreich," said Nerzin reproachfully.
A smile of good-natured artfulness made Potapov's wrinkles deeper. Straightening his glasses, he answered,
"I was sharing a cell in the Lyubyanka with Count Esterhazy once, carrying the night bucket out on even dates, you know how it goes, while he did it on odd ones, and teaching him Russian from the prison rules on the wall, and I gave him 3 buttons made out of bread as a birthday present. All his buttons had been cut off, and he swore that not one of the Habsburgs had ever given him a more welcome present."
In the classification of voices, Potapov's was described as toneless and crackly. Still hanging head down, Nerzin gazed affectionately at Potapov's rugged face. With his glasses he looked no older than his 40 years and still quite vigorous, but when he took them off, the dark hollows under his eyes were those of a death's head.
"But you embarrass me, Andreich. I can't give you anything like this. I haven't got hands like yours. How did you manage to remember my birthday? Are there any other notable dates in our lives here?"
They sighed.
"Want some tea?" Potapov asked. "It's my special brew." "No, Andreich, I haven't got time for tea. I'm getting a visit today." "Great. Your old woman?"
"Uh-huh."
"Hey, you, Valentula, stop generating smoke right by my ear. What right does one person have to bully other people?"
"What's in the paper, Andreich?"
Nerzin asked. Potapov looked up at Nerzin's suspended face with a crafty Ukrainian squint. "Tall tales from the Britannic muse, the budding maiden's dreams confuse.
They have the barefaced impudence to maintain that—"
Nerzin and Potapov had met in the 2nd year after the war, nearly 4 years ago, in a restless, rackety, overcrowded Butyrki cell, half dark even in mid-July. There, and at that time, the most wildly different careers, the unlikeliest paths, crossed. The latest influx was from Europe. Through the cell passed novices still cherishing faint memories of European freedom, sturdy Russian prisoners of war, exchanging a German stalag for their fatherland's gulag, hammer-hardened and hot-forged veterans of the camps, in transit from the cave dwellings of the gulag to the oases of the Sharashkas. When he got into the cell, Nerzin slid flat on his belly under the bedboards, they were close to the ground, and down there on the asphalt floor, before he could make anything out in the dark, cheerfully asked, "Who's last in the line, friends?" A cracked, unmusical voice replied,
"Cuckoo, you're after me."
After that they moved along, under the bedboards, from day to day, as men were pulled out for posting, away from the pale and toward the window. And in the 3rd week they began the return journey back, from the window toward the pale, but by now on top of the bedboards. Later on they shuffled toward the window across the wooden boards once more. That was how Nerzin and Potapov became firm friends, in spite of differences in age, background, and taste. There it was that Potapov, in the weary months of brooding after his trial, confessed to Nerzin that he had never taken any interest in politics, and never would have, if politics hadn't laid about him and kicked his ribs in. There, under the bedboards in the Butyrki prison, the robot, for the first time in his life, began to wonder, which, as everybody knows, is bad for robots. No, he still did not regret refusing German rations. He did not regret the 3 lost years awaiting death from starvation in captivity. And, as before, he thought there should be no question of submitting our internal disorders to the judgment of foreigners. But the spark of doubt had fallen into his mind and smouldered. For the very first time, the perplexed robot had asked himself, what the hell was the Dnieper power station built for, anyway?